the bankruptcy court yet. None of those have been approved. So what we're talking to you about today is a proposed plan and a proposed disclosure statement filed with the bankruptcy court, as well as a motion that was filed by the committee and the debtors seeking bankruptcy court approval of the disclosure statement so that the court can then allow us to send that disclosure statement with the plan and ballots to you to vote on to approve. So today's call is just the preliminary discussion and summary of what this plan and disclosure statement provides generally. We're not soliciting your votes today. We're not asking you to vote for the plan. We're just simply telling you what it provides and answering some of your questions. There will be a more substantial call and a further call after the disclosure statement is approved, because that's the document that will ultimately be reviewed by all of you to approve the plan or not. And it will also include modifications, if any, to the plan by that date as well. So procedurally, we're just going to discuss where we are now in a draft plan stage, a proposed plan stage, I should say, a proposed disclosure statement, and not a court-approved document yet. So a substantial amount of work has gone into this document and these documents in order to negotiate and develop a plan that deals with the real estate, deals with the preservation of rights regarding litigation, and the structure of a post-bankruptcy trust or vehicle by which the company's assets will be developed and or sold and will ultimately generate a revenue and recovery for investors and rights to litigate against all the bad actors, some of which is ongoing, some of which is going to be rapidly accelerated, will be preserved and pursued post emergence from bankruptcy. So I'm going to give you a very, very quick 30,000 foot description. And some of you have heard this as in our discussion of a general terms of how this plan will be structured, but that is how, in fact, it is structured. And I'll discuss it now in general terms. Mike will then delve into more detail, and we'll also answer some questions that you've posed, as well as some general discussion regarding the plan going forward. So generally speaking, what this plan does is it provides for the creation post-bankruptcy, as soon as the plan is confirmed and documents are executed, confirmed meaning approved by the court, which will be months from now, there will be an order entered. That order will confirm and approve the plan and disclosure statement, or in the plan. That plan will then go into effect, which will be an effective date after all these documents to consummate the plan are executed. Then there will be a trust created. That trust will be created that will hold all the assets of the debtors. That those assets will include the cash and the interest in various property holding companies below the trust. So the trust will be on top. There will be entities below that will be operating, developing, and liquidating the properties so that the properties can be developed and sold and liquidated for your benefit. The cash will go back up to the trust and then distributed to all of the allowed creditors and allowed investors in the case. So with allowed claims. So that's a very, very general overview. There'll be a trustee appointed that the committee and the court will approve. There will be a person or entity operating the property level debtors, just so that they, or I should say property level entities, because they'll be no longer be in bankruptcy. They'll be out of bankruptcy. They'll be operating that person will operate the real property entities for purposes of completing the development and or sale of those properties. And that's all they'll do. And then those proceeds will go back up, as I mentioned, to the trust for distribution to creditors and investors. The liquidation trustee will have the right as well to pursue the litigation claims we talked about. The plan also incorporates a settlement that Mike's going to get into in greater detail. And that settlement is a way of streamlining and making the bankruptcy process and claims resolution process and distribution to creditors more rapid, more effective, more efficient, and less drug out in litigation so that there'll be a more rapid and fair distribution to creditors. And Mike will explain that in greater detail as well. They will be overlooking, overseeing the trustee. Will be a small board of three people called the Liquidation Trust Advisory Board. And that board will simply be a sounding board, if you wish, for the trustee to make sure that if they want to see, wants to settle something, and that, you know, wants to sell properties, and that trustee advisory board, that liquidation advisory board, will be comprised of two individuals selected by the committee and one by the debtors. And that trustee, as I mentioned, will be selected by the committee and approved by the court. So that's the governance of the debtor, or the entities, I should say, no longer the debtor, after the bankruptcy, under this proposed plan, and as described in the disclosure statement. The plan and disclosure statement, like every other plan and disclosure statement, breaks out various classes of creditors and investors, and it's broken out in the disclosure statement by class. The investors are the general investors are in the investor class, class five. Then there's also a non-investor general unsecured class. And then there are subordinated creditors, and there are secured creditors, all of which are treated differently under the plan and disclosure statement. And they're provided in greater detail there. But one of the most important aspects of this plan and its structure is the contributing investor settlement built into the plan. And that idea there, in, and Mike will get into it in detail, is essentially a settlement between the company and the investors in a way that we hope is able to resolve the claims of investors, avoid litigation against investors, and expedite distribution to investors. So, Mike, why don't you go ahead and take it from there?
Sure. And just one... One more thing before we get started. This is our initial draft of the plan. It's jointly proposed by the debtors and the committee. Plans are frequently amended. So this is unlikely to be anywhere near the, I mean, it's unlikely to be a final version, but this is the framework that we proposed, and we hope and expect that most of the changes that will come through the process will be minor and not fundamentally change the structure of the plan, subject obviously to approval. So as Lewis mentioned, there are two key components of the plan. There's the contributing investor settlement, and then there's substantive consolidation. I'll talk about contributing investor settlement first. So under the plan, we propose a contributing investor settlement, which investors can choose to participate in. If they do not wish to participate in, then they can make an election to opt out of the contributing investor settlement. The way you opt, you don't have to do anything to opt in. If you don't submit a ballot or you vote to affirm the plan and you don't check the box that says I opt out, then you will be opted into the settlement under the plan and you will receive the treatment that I'm going to discuss in a second. If, on the other hand, you either select the opt-out option on your ballot, which we will explain in more detail at the next meeting, or you file an objection to the plan or you vote to reject the plan, then you will be deemed to opt out of the settlement. The settlement won't apply to you. So there, the settlement itself has several key aspects. The first aspect is how claims are valued for settling investors. The plan includes a defined term called the net investor claim amount. All investors who are contributing investors would have their claim valued and allowed at the net investor claim amount. The net investor claim amount is calculated by looking simply at all the cash that investors invested into NRIA and its various entities, minus all the cash that investors received from NRIA, period. So it's just the cash in minus cash out to get essentially at your outstanding principal amount. So there is no calculation of any sort of rate of return included in that. And there's no roll-up bonus, non-cash roll-up bonus, or phantom interest that people received in their principal calculation from the debtor. It's simply the amount of cash that you gave the debtors minus the cash that you received back from the debtors. The net investor claim amount for every investor will be listed on a schedule, the investor schedule, which will be filed shortly. It hasn't been filed yet, but it will be filed shortly, hopefully by next Tuesday, but if not, then soon after that. Which will list the total amount. It'll list the net investor claim amount for every investor. It'll also list out the amounts to get at that calculation, the total amount that that investor, according to the debtor's books and records, paid in, plus it'll also list the total amount that that investor's received out, and then to arrive at the net investor claim amount. There's another aspect. There's an excluded party list that is also going to be attached to the plan. This is a list of parties, both, you know, the Grabados, the Salzanos, the Scutaros of the world, who are insiders and will not get to participate in any sort of settlement or any release or anything like that under the plan. They will not get any treatment under any special treatment under the plan, plus a small number of investors who effectively received about 100% of their return prior to the bankruptcy case. I'd say about 95% of investors receive less than 40% of their capital back. In fact, it's probably more like 98% of investors receive less than 40% of their capital back. But the excluded party list really only lists a couple people who received much, much, much more than that back. And the reason that's important is because in exchange for contributing, for agreeing to the contributing investor settlement, investors who are settling investors will be immune from clawback actions. They will receive a release and a waiver of any clawback actions, which are actions that a debtor usually pursues to recover fraudulent transfers and preferences that basically are pre-petition distributions that those creditors received in the 4 years prior to the bankruptcy case's filing. So, for example, if you do not accept the contributing investor settlement and you invested $100,000 in the debtor, but you received $30,000 back, ordinarily, you would be subject to a clawback action for the $30,000 that you received. You would then, you know, have a claim for $100,000 total and not just $70,000. Under the plan, rather than pursue all of those clawback actions, the settlement would just give you an allowed claim at $70,000. Now, when I say claim, one thing it's important to keep in mind here is this is just the nominal amount of claims. As it states under the plan, we estimate that investors, just taking into account the debtor's current assets, their current cash, their current real estate, and not taking into account any litigation recoveries against third parties, if we just look at the real estate, the estimates are currently that investors would receive between 25 and 30% on the dollar of their investment amount. The net investor claim amount is really just your denominator, effectively. It's the amount that you will receive on your claim multiplied by whatever the ultimate distribution is in the case. Another important aspect of the contributing investor settlement is the contribution of claims. Under the contributing investor settlement, contributing investors would be deemed to have contributed any claims they may have against third parties, such as the Grabados and the Salzanos of the world, and other related parties like potentially U.S. construction they might pursue individually, but that wouldn't necessarily make sense economically for them to pursue individually. So under the contributing investor settlement, all of the contributing investors would contribute their claims to the trust to pursue on their behalf for everyone. Additionally, under the contributing investor settlement, contributing investors would be deemed to have contributed and effectively waived any rights they have under joint venture agreements. The debtors gave out many joint ventures agreements, thousands of joint venture agreements, under documents with terms that were ambiguous and undefined, and that we believe, based on our review, are unenforceable. Even to the extent they are enforceable, there's language in the joint venture agreements and the vast majority of the joint venture agreements that say that the joint venture interest is not payable until after the fund investors have been paid. So for that reason, we have basically classified the joint venture agreement subordinately below the repayment of investors in full. And so therefore, as part of the settlement, contributing investors would be deemed to have contributed any claims they might have on joint venture agreements to the trust. Additionally, as part of the contributing investor settlement, we will be seeking findings of fact in the confirmation order, which is the order basically saying that the plan meets all the requirements of the bankruptcy code and therefore can be confirmed. We will be seeking findings of fact with respect to the existence of a Ponzi scheme and other things which we are hopeful will help investors pursue claims they might have against taxing authorities and otherwise, However, we're not going to talk too much about that specifically. You should talk to your own accountants and your own attorneys, your own individual attorneys, about how that can help you. The upside of agreeing to the settlement is that investors that are settling investors will come out of the plan confirmation process with an allowed claim and no clawback actions against them. And so as soon as the trustee is ready to make a distribution, an interim distribution to investors who are, they will be able to pay out on those claims, at least a portion. With respect to the investors that opt out of the settlement or are not otherwise eligible for it, they will not be entitled to receive a distribution until, first off, their claim has been allowed. So any objections to their claim have been filed and resolved, which can take time. And until after any clawback actions have been both filed, pursued, settled, and or paid. And so it might be some time before investors that are not contributing investors have their claims fully settled and resolved and allowed so that they are entitled to receive a distribution. So that is the contributing investor settlement. It is laid out in detail in the plan. It is discussed in detail in the disclosure statement, and you'll find more information there. The second major component of the plan is substantive.
Let me just add one thing to your very good summary of the contributing investor settlement before we get into substantive consolidation. It is a cornerstone of the plan, and it's in a very important part of the plan. And the reason for that is, from our perspective, you heard there's 25 to 35% as stated in the plan disclosure statement at page 11 of distribution available out of the real property for investors out of the real property. There's no recovery from litigation in that number. The litigation against the third parties is made incredibly much stronger by the contribution of investor claims to the trust so that we could pursue those claims on behalf of everyone, not out of your pocket, but out of the pockets of the trust, to pursue that recovery for everyone's recovery. And it would be a litigation on the trust for all investors and creditors of the trust to recover from all wrongdoers and people who aided and abetted in that. And there's substantial claims that are being developed as we speak. So I just wanted to say it's a very important part of the plan, and it's intended to enhance recoveries for all investors and creditors. Sorry, Mike, go ahead with the
Just to add on to that, the reason why the contribution to claims is so helpful is because as the as counsel for the committee, the committee has been investigating these claims. The committee has been able to take advantage of Rule 2004 of the Bankruptcy Code, which is a rule that allows very extensive discovery, meaning document requests, depositions of third parties, in order to fully develop claims against them. And so we believe that the liquidation trust will be in the best position to pursue those claims, not the least of which because they'll have the assets, they'll basically be able to spread the costs across the entire creditor body, and it won't have to be borne by one or two or a subset of the creditors. So the second major component, the second pillar of the plan, is something called substantive consolidation. Now, this is a bankruptcy concept. It's a highly technical bankruptcy concept, but essentially what it says is that what we're going to do is we're going to combine all the debtors together effectively, and then outside of the bankruptcy case, all of the investors in any of the entities will share from the same pot based on how much they invested in versus how much they invested out. The committee and committee counsel and the committee's advisors, we spent a great deal of time investigating the debtors' books and records in an effort to try and unwind their assets and liabilities and separate them out by entity, because that was our first goal, was to try and basically put Humpty Dumpty back together again. But as we found, and as that story goes, it simply was not possible. There are a number of different conflicting legal rights that are unclear and ambiguous, and that are basically the result of the debtor's Ponzi scheme, that make it functionally impossible to equitably, practically, and cost-effectively unwind the debtor's assets and liabilities. And ultimately, the determination we reached was that the cost of attempting to unwind and allocate the assets and liabilities, and the cost and time and litigation that would ensue if we actually basically did that for every single debtor entity, for every single intercompany receivable, for every single interdebtor guarantee, would basically wipe out any advantage that any one creditor or any one group of creditors would receive over any others. And so therefore, we believed it was equitable for everyone and would have the largest distribution for everyone if, rather than engage in 10 years of litigation to do that, we substantively consolidate the debtors. So therefore, whether you have an investment in a property level debtor or an investment in the fund, you will receive the same percentage recovery. Another important aspect of this is because of the way the debtors ran their business, they used the fund investors' investments to pay earlier investors to basically develop the property level investments and to pay out to the property level investors. And so we felt that if we were to, one thing we didn't want to do is we didn't want to arrive at a solution that would effectually carry out the Ponzi scheme that the debtors pursued. And so on top of realizing that it would just be too costly to try and unwind everything, we believe that this is the most equitable result for everyone. We've talked briefly about joint venture agreements. Under the plan, joint venture agreements and any rights under joint venture agreements are subordinated to investors. We believe that the joint venture agreements are invalid and ambiguous, and therefore, if people elect to opt out of the contributing investor settlement and seek to enforce their rights under the joint venture agreements, those claims will be, in all likelihood, objected to. Not the least of which, because the terms of the joint venture agreements, in terms of what people were entitled to get, the net profits that people were entitled to get, is unclear and ambiguous and uncertain in terms of what they would even get, even if they had the rights. So that is why we have pushed the joint venture agreements down below the investor claims. Another aspect of this is in terms of the guaranteed rate of return that NRIA promised to investors, the 12% per annum guaranteed return. There are a couple elements of that that we believed made that unenforceable and also inequitable. First off, we do not believe that those are necessarily enforceable. Under the terms of the agreements, the operating agreements of the fund and the other entities, any returns on investments aren't payable until all principal has been returned to everyone. So therefore, it wouldn't make sense to calculate claims for earlier investors who accrued large returns. That's not what their rights are under the agreement. Under the agreements, everybody should receive all of their capital back before anybody receives any guaranteed return. Recognizing that investors who invested earlier will have accrued large amounts of guaranteed returns, we looked at that and compared that to the potential clawback actions that we could pursue against investors. And we reached the determination that it made the most sense, we believed, both in terms of the cost to the estate, the likelihood of recovering from investors who we know have, invested most of their life, many of whom have invested most of their life savings into this company, that rather than try and litigate to recover on clawback actions, we would agree to waive any clawback actions against contributing investors rather than pursue them. And this has the effect essentially of balancing the negative impact on earlier investors from waiving their guaranteed claims against the harder hit to earlier investors of pursuing clawback actions. So it was a balance in terms of that. All told, as we mentioned earlier, we estimate currently, given the values of the debtor's real estate in the current real estate market, that the value that investors would receive if we only pursued and sold the real estate would be between 25 and 35% on the dollar for their claim. Again, as Lewis mentioned, that does not account for any recoveries that are made in litigation against the bad actors. That would be above and beyond that 25 to 35%. So those are the principal components of the plan. Lewis, is there anything else we should talk about in terms of the components?
I don't think so. I think the only thing I would say is that those of you who are listening and have any questions regarding the plan, obviously we will do our best to answer some of those here today. We will also do our best to answer questions that you may have not on this call, but you should have, to the extent you deem it appropriate, your own counsel regarding the plan and disclosure statement. Read it, understand how it impacts you both substantively on your dollar amount, but also on your tax implications of your investment, etc. So please make sure you seek your own individual counsel regarding each of these provisions Mike is talking about. Some of it is hyper-technical. And one thing I'll say before we go on to the timing and the process related to the plan, and we're going to try to keep this call within an hour, is this. When Mike says we decided to do this or we decided to do that, or I said we thought about doing this, or we thought we were concerned about X, what we're talking about is months and months of legal analysis and financial analysis hand in glove with Alvarez and Marcel and as we indicated, a world-class financial advisory firm, as well as counsel to the debtors and the board, which included two retired bankruptcy judges, in order to structure something that was compliant with the bankruptcy code as we understand it, that would be confirmable as a matter of law, meaning approvable by the court as a matter of law, that treated each class of creditor in accordance with applicable bankruptcy law and what was fair based upon their agreements with the debtors and with their understanding of the expectations. The problem is that we have limited assets, and the assets are the real estate that was in part partially impacted as well by macroeconomic issues like interest rates and other issues. So the litigation will be a substantial portion of our recovery going forward, we hope. And we anticipate that to be a focus, as well as the continuation and resolution of the real estate, a focus of getting a maximum recovery. That's why the contribution claims are so important, in our view, to the resolution of this case, because if everyone goes different ways with litigation on their own or otherwise, you'll have multiple people attempting to get limited assets from limited people, and nobody will get a maximum return. And the only way to do it is have one giant bomb, that's us, and the trust going after the bad actors and getting the maximum recovery. That's our view. But anyway, let's go on with the plan process. Go ahead, Mike.
Great. So as you noticed, last Tuesday we filed the plan, the debtors filed a joint plan disclosure statement, which attaches the plan as an exhibit and describes all the terms of the plan, and a motion to approve solicitation. The motion to approve solicitation obviously is the first step. That puts before the bankruptcy court the disclosure statement, which under the bankruptcy code has to contain adequate information upon which creditors and investors on the plan can make an informed decision as to whether or not to approve it. So the first step here is to get the court to approve the disclosure statement. Objections to the disclosure statement and to the solicitation motion are due on or before May 9th at 4 p.m., after which we'll have a better idea of at least the initial reaction to the disclosure statement. And the hearing to approve the disclosure statement is on May 16th, Tuesday, May 16th at 10 a.m. After, and that is all subject to change. If there something comes up, or if the court wants to push things back, or if there are substantial changes that investors make and it is determined that changes need to be made to the plan, that can always be pushed back. Our goal right now, though, is to get to that disclosure statement hearing on May 16th. After the disclosure statement is approved, the debtors working with Omni will be sending out solicitation packages to all investors, plus the solicitation version of the disclosure statement and plan, which will in all likelihood have minor amendments and be updated from what is currently on the docket, will be mailed out to all investors and available on Omni to download. Additionally, the solicitation package will have a QR code, so you may, with your phone, scan it and pull it up on your computer or on your phone. The solicitation package will in all likelihood be distributed with a USB key fob, which rather than send you 200 pages of paper, so you will need to, you'll be able to stick that into your computer and download and open the plan and disclosure statement to review them that way rather than be overwhelmed with a bunch of paper. The solicitation package, when it is mailed out, will include a ballot for your claim. Each individual investor will have an individual and specific ballot for themselves, which will list on it the amount of your claim, the net investor amount that's on the schedule. Again, the investor schedule will list all claims, and you can look at that, and you can look at how you come out. But your individual claim will be set forth on your Class 5 ballot. Now, we will talk more about the ballots and how to fill them out and how to read them at the later call after the disclosure statement has been approved. But just that's what will happen. Once you receive your ballot, you would want to send that in to either show your support for the plan or to reject the plan, or to show your support for the plan but opt out of the contributing investor settlement. There are instructions in the plan and the disclosure statement currently on how to do that, but you will also receive instructions with the solicitation package after it is sent out. I believe the current plan is that ballots may be submitted online on the Omni website, and as part of the next meeting, we will show you how to do that, so you know how to do that. And again, there are always instructions you can fill out. I believe you may also be able to mail ballots in, but I'm not certain of that. And frankly, to make sure that your ballot is cast and received, it's probably better to do it on the Omni site. After the ballots are sent out, there are additional documents that will be submitted to the bankruptcy court for everybody's review in connection with the plan that are important documents governing how the liquidation entity will work after the plan is confirmed. The principal one of these documents is what's called a liquidation trust agreement. Now, this is a highly technical document that explains what the liquidation trustee's powers are, what authority he or she has, and what the rights of the liquidation trust advisory board are, what oversight rights they have, and then what the rights are to control the wind down CEO, who is the individual who will be principally responsible, subject to the control of the liquidation trustee, for finishing the development and the sale of the real estate assets that the debtors still have. The deadline for submitting ballots, which is also the deadline for filing objections to the plan, is currently slated for July 11th at 5 p.m. All ballots need to be submitted by that 5 p.m. deadline on July 11th, and any objections need to be filed on the docket by July 11th at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. If you would like to file an objection, you need to retain an attorney in order to prepare and file that objection. Somebody who is admitted in the District of New Jersey and can obtain temporary admission, who has rights to electronically file and submit that objection. Our response as the plan proponents, our joint response with the debtors, and our brief and confirmation of the plan will be filed after that on or before July 18th, if the current schedule holds. And then the confirmation hearing is currently scheduled for July 25th at 10 a.m. Again, other than the objection deadline to the solicitation motion and the disclosure statement hearing, all of those other dates are tentative and depend upon the court's approval of the disclosure statement. On July 25th, at the confirmation hearing, we are hopeful that the plan will be confirmed, after which there are a number of actions that need to be taken in order to put the plan into effect. That doesn't usually take that long, but essentially what needs to happen is that all the liquidation trust agreement and the other relevant documents need to be signed and executed, and everybody needs to be put in place. Once all of those conditions have been met, the plan will become effective, and all the rights that are listed under the plan would take effect. Lewis, can I turn to you for the post-confirmation activities?
Sure. So once that plan is confirmed, and once the order is entered confirming the plan, the trust goes into effect, and that trust becomes the vehicle through which distributions are recovered and then made to investors. And the trustee will be doing so with the authority given under that trust agreement, as well as under the order of confirmation. There will be a process by which claims that have been voted in favor of the plan will be allowed in the amounts stated in those documents. But those who do not vote in favor of the plan and or opt out of the plan and are not settling in claimants or investors as contributing investors, then those claims may be pursued for clawback against those creditors, possibly. For amounts that they might have received prior to the bankruptcy as distributions. So that is something that the trustee would be pursuing and examining. The massive causes of action, the more substantial causes of action against third parties, will be pursued by the trustee through the counsel to the trustee. And that litigation will be on behalf of all investors who are contributing investors for the recovery against all their bad actors. And obviously information regarding your distributions, any type of information regarding recoveries will be periodically provided. And the trustee will be providing reports on the docket, but also may periodically be providing calls like this as updates to investors regarding the trust administration. So I guess that's really all we need to really touch on right now, I think, Mike, in terms of that. There'll be, of course, as I mentioned, the operation below of the property level debtors, where they'll be going through the process of selling. The disclosure statement provides detail as to the real estate, but we do have a brief presentation, I believe, or a discussion regarding that from Alvarez, or no, is it Alvarez?
No, we're going to, in the interest of time, to make sure we have time to get your questions, the disclosure statement, which was filed last week, contains a detailed description of the status of each of the debtors' current real estate projects, what they anticipate doing with respect to each of the individual projects. So rather than go through that right now, we're going to defer on that just so we have time to really answer questions.
Go ahead, Mike.
The next major subject we want to discuss before we get to the questions was tax concerns. Trust me, we have heard you. The committee is very, very concerned, as I know all of you are, with respect to the status of the K-1s that the debtors should have been issuing with respect to each of your investments so that you can file your taxes. This is not an easy process for them, although they should be getting things out earlier. But they have received an extended deadline for filing their tax returns for last year, meaning for the 2022 year, to September 15th. And it is anticipated that they will likely not file their tax returns before that September 15th deadline. K-1s for 2022 will in all likelihood only be issued when the return is filed. So therefore, unfortunately, as much as I hate this, it is unlikely that anybody will get any K-1s for 2022 before September 15th of this year. There's also been some discussions as to whether or not there's a need to amend prior year tax returns and potentially amend K-1s to ensure that loss amounts are not lost to investors, but we will have more information on that in the future. Additionally, the confirmation of the bankruptcy plan and the emergence of the entity into a post-bankruptcy entity should not affect or should only have a should in all likelihood only have a change in form in terms of the paperwork you get for the filing of your tax returns. It will not mean that you will never receive a K-1 for prior years or for last year just because the plan has emerged. So you shouldn't need to worry about that. The last thing, and I'm just going to mention this, we're not going to give you specific advice about this. But we are putting findings of fact in the plan with respect to the existence of a Ponzi scheme. There may be tax provisions that may enable you to take a loss. This is not an area in which I have a great deal of expertise. This is something you need to talk to your individual attorney about and your individual accountant as to whether or not you could potentially take a tax loss deduction on your tax returns. So those are the issues on our agenda. And then I think we are moving to questions. We have questions that were submitted by everyone in the registration. We'll hit those first, and then depending on time, we'll try and get through as many of the questions in the Q&A as possible. The first question, opening question, what has occurred to progress this case towards resolution since your last creditors town hall? Well, the main thing is we filed our plan and disclosure statement, which is the most important thing that needs to happen in a bankruptcy case to move it forward. Additionally, a great deal of work has continued on assessing, developing, and selling the real estate, but the principal amount of effort that has gone in the last several months has been to develop documents and file the plan and disclosure statement, which we just talked about. The next question, an investor posed the question, why hire an additional attorney and risk losing even more money than I already have when Ice Miller is representing us? Now, if you've attended these town halls before, you've heard us say multiple times, we, Ice Miller, represent the committee. Specifically, we do not represent any individual investors. We represent the interests of investors and creditors generally. So if there's a general issue, we represent the entire body of investors and creditors generally. We do not represent any investors or creditors individually. And if you have an individual problem or you need legal advice personally, you need to retain your own attorney to opine on those, to give you the answers that you need. We cannot give individual advice to investors.
Let me refine that a little bit, just to be specific, because of the concern you have in that question. We don't represent any creditors at all, generally, at all. We represent only the committee. Our committee has a duty to represent the interests as a fiduciary of all creditors. We don't represent any creditors generally. However, those two duties, the fiduciary duty of the committee, along with our representation of the committee in that exercise, is in furtherance of all of your interests, because they are representing, meaning the committee is representing your interests generally in the bankruptcy case. That includes when the court gives them authority, gives the committee authority, or in this case, likely the liquidating trustee, the authority to pursue these claims that we've identified and are investigating, then those claims will be pursued on your behalf through the trust. So, you know, the answer is there's not another attorney or firm being hired necessarily at all. The trust is going to be actually less in terms of professionals, because debtors' professionals will be gone. And so there will be, in all likelihood, counsel, one single set of counsel for the trustee, one single set of, a subset of attorneys just for the real estate, one for the litigation. But that's less than we have now. We have board counsel, we have debtor counsel, we have committee counsel, et cetera. So I think that it'd be actually less counsel, generally speaking, going forward. So hopefully that answers your question. There will be one set really focused on these recoveries from the litigation perspective. So next questions are tax questions, I guess.
Yes, tax questions. I'm just going to go through these quickly. And again, I'm not going to give individual tax advice here. With respect to most tax questions, you need to consult with your own accountant and your own tax attorney. First question is, when is NRIA's return due, and why do we need to wait to get our K-1? Our taxes are being messed up along with our finances. We understand that the inability to get a K-1 from the debtors is very, very difficult and makes it impossible for you to file your tax returns. The NRIA tax return for 2022, the deadline was, they got an extension, and they should be filing on or before September 15th. And our understanding is that the K-1s for 2022 should be issued at that point. We have had discussions with the debtors about seeing if we can expedite that. But it's a very difficult thing to do, especially with the plan confirmation coming up. Second question is, why is the K-1 for us being held up by the company's return? My understanding is that the K-1 is issued along with the return, but that's the best I can say. What is the discovery date that should be used to file a tax loss under IRS Rev Proc 2009-20EV? We don't have any information on this. There might be more information forthcoming, but for right now, we don't have any information as to when the discovery date should be for the tax loss. There is the issue of valuing portfolio fund investments that are in IRAs. Custodian requires support from NRIA or an expert. If you require specific information that is not available from the plan, if your accountant has reviewed the plan and disclosure statement and the filings in the case, and there is specific additional information that you believe that they believe that you need, please send us an email with that specific information that you believe that you need. But otherwise, we don't have any additional information to give at this time. The next question was, this has been designated a Ponzi scheme by the IRS. It would appear from the revenue proc that we as investors would qualify for the theft loss deduction under those provisions. First off, we are not aware of the IRS having specifically designated this case as a Ponzi scheme. I'm not sure where that came from. And the applicability of the theft loss deduction is a question for your own individual accountants. The next question, which was from the same person, was, Our acceptance of the plan and our election to not opt out of the contributing investor settlement prohibits us, the investor, from pursuing any claim against the debtor. Would you agree that this would make investors eligible to file a Ponzi scheme tax deduction in the 95% category? First off, just to be clear, if you participate in the contributing investor settlement, then you will have a claim against the debtor allowed in the amount of your net investor claim amount that is listed on the schedule. So it is not that you won't be able to pursue any claim against the debtor. That is the claim that you have pursued against the debtor. In terms of whether that makes what the recoveries in this case make individual investors eligible for with respect to the theft loss deduction, again, you're going to have to talk to your own individual accountants and your own attorneys about how that applies to your particular situation. The next section of questions is on recoveries. There's a question, date for restoring normal distributions. Someone asked when things are going to get back to normal and the debtors are going to start giving normal monthly distributions again. I believe we've stated this in each of the prior town halls. This debtor is not going to be returning to normal distributions. There is not going to be a return to the business that it was before. This debtor is not going back to the way it operated before, because before it was operating as a Ponzi scheme. We will not be, there will not be any return to the pre-bankruptcy normal as it is. The next question, when will I get money back and how much? I can't speak to when. Our hope is that we will be making distributions, that the liquidation trust will be making distributions over time after the effective date. I can't speak to when the earliest distributions will be, but they will likely come back in a series of interim distributions until all the assets have been distributed out. In the disclosure statement, we set forth our estimates on how much will be distributed on claims and investment claims. Investors, based on our current estimates, based on the current real estate values, which is all subject to change, is that if we only look to the debtor's current cash and real estate, then recoveries will be between 25 and 35% of the net investor claim amount. If we, and then with any recoveries in terms of litigation recoveries coming on top of that. What is the likelihood of recovering the money that was stolen? So that's a very broad question. There are claims that can be pursued against third parties. There are a lot of parties to pursue. The liquidation trust will and can and will go after those people that that there are viable claims against. The question of how much can be recovered is a difficult question. To the extent money was stolen and it was parked and it's sitting in a bank account, it's very easy to get that back potentially. Depending on the ability of the claim, if it's sitting there and we can identify that asset, then potentially we can get that back. If somebody took the money and they, used it for a bunch of expensive dinners and other things that just aren't there anymore, then that money is in all likelihood gone and can't be recovered. So while we are going to pursue everything we can, it's not like all the money that was stolen is just sitting there for us to claw it back and bring it back to the estate. Some of that money will have dissipated and will not be there anymore. So we will pursue all the claims we have, and we will make as much of an effort to maximize the value, but it's not like it's just there to be taken, to be brought back into the estate.
Let me add to that though, Mike, which is that's what Mike's talking about is actual recovery of diverted cash in and actual diverted assets. There are claims, substantial claims that we've developed and are exploring against others who may be culpable in assisting or aiding in the fraud that was committed. They may not have received broad distributions or substantial distributions, but they may be culpable for aiding and facilitating the fraud. So with those claims may be very substantial, even if they didn't, and they may be deep pockets. We're not for sure exactly the degree of culpability yet in full. We have depositions coming up in May, for example, against U.S. Constructions. That is an entity against whom we are pursuing a substantial investigation. We have other buckets of targets that are both those who may have assisted in the fraud, benefited from the fraud, and may have dissipated cash, but are otherwise deep pockets. So we are going to be pursuing these claims fully, hopefully, if the liquidation trustee proceeds with those claims. So go ahead, Mike. Sorry.
There's a question. Update on cash available for investors and property sales. So in terms of the cash that the debtors currently have, as of April 8th, the debtors had approximately $55 million of cash. Now, that cash is being held for a number of things. First off, there are a number of secured claims and other claims that need to be paid out. General unsecured claims have priority over investor claims and therefore would need to be paid out in full before investors can recover anything. Additionally, in order to continue to develop the properties, the most cost-effective way to do that, subject to review and analysis, is potentially to use that cash to develop the properties, to turn it into, to increase the value and potentially grow that cash by developing the properties. So while there is $55 million currently in the debtors' accounts, that is not a money that is available for distribution to investors right now. And it really, the distributions of cash will depend on when the properties sell and the value for those sales. The next question, will unsecured creditors in the fund receive their absolute and unconditionally guaranteed 12% annualized preferred return? As I mentioned previously, we do not intend to pay the 12% guaranteed return that, or the 12% return that the debtors purportedly guaranteed to investors, when they made their investment, for a number of reasons, not the least of which because the documents basically provide that everybody has to receive all of their principal back before any of the guaranteed returns, quote unquote, are paid. Investors who do not opt out of the settlement would have a claim that does not include a 12% annual return. Investors that opt out of the settlement and seek to recover their 12% guaranteed return will receive a claim objection with respect to that amount for that reason.
I think, let me add to that, Mike, just real quickly. It's not that we don't intend to. It's that the returns are fictitious. These returns were fraudulent. The 12% returns that people were promised and were being paid were coming from other investors' funds. So the reality is that these properties were not generating necessarily revenue that was generating the 12% returns you were receiving or may have been receiving. So in other words, we can't pay a 12% rate of return. Not we, the estate can. We're just advisors. The estate cannot pay a 12% rate of return to investors as promised in these documents because it doesn't exist. So that's it. Mike, go ahead. Sorry.
There are a couple of questions about the real estate. I'm going to just point everybody to the disclosure statement, which includes a thorough discussion of the status of each of the real estate assets. And we will have a subsequent call where we discuss the status of the real estate. But for now, that's what I'm going to do. Has anyone looked at what the liquidation value of assets would be at their current state of completion? Again, I believe that's set forth in the disclosure statement, but there will be a liquidation analysis that will be filed together with the investor schedule that'll set forth what everybody would receive if this case was converted to a straight-up liquidation under Chapter 7 of the Bankruptcy Code, which will show that the recoveries that we anticipate under the plan should be significantly better than the recoveries that people would receive in a liquidation. So that liquidation analysis should be filed hopefully in the next week or so that everybody will have a chance to review it before the objection deadline with respect to the disclosure statement. Class action lawsuits. Lewis, you want to take this one? How are the class action lawsuits affecting the resolution for creditors? Should we join the class action lawsuits if we submitted a claim?
So we're not going to give you advice as to whether or not you should join a class action or not. That's your independent decision. But I can tell you that if you submitted a claim and you intend to vote in favor of the plan and or accept becoming a contributing investor, then your claims will have been transferred to the estate, and the estate should have the ability to pursue those claims on your behalf at no additional cost to you other than distributions out of the trust that would be recoverable for you. And that would be, in our view, the best way of maximizing the return to investors in this case. It is historically the way the claims are contributed so that the claims can be pursued on a collective basis against all wrongdoers. Multiple causes of action and lawsuits against the same source of recovery results in multiple people picking apart the defendant in a way that does not maximize, in our view, always the recovery. So it's your independent decision, but if you don't become a contributing investor and contribute your claims against third parties to the trust, Then you'd be free to pursue the class actions and also be subject potentially to the treatment under the plan as a non-contributing investor. But either way, we have had some discussions with counsel to the class action, certain of the class action plaintiffs, and would continue to have an open dialogue with them. That's all.
The next set of questions related to the plan and disclosure statement, many of which we've already gone over, so I'm just going to go through them quickly. We already gave a timeline and explanation of the plan. We already discussed how claims would be calculated. Just to reiterate, it's actual cash that was paid in minus actual cash that was paid back out. So it's basically your net principal investment at this stage, as of the petition date. Among the LLCs that NRIA filed for Chapter 11, do all of them give NRIA the exclusive legal right to file Chapter 11? This is a legal issue specific to certain of the debtors. All of the debtors that filed for Chapter 11 that are currently in the case, we believe were properly authorized to do so, but we can't say whether they had the exclusive legal right to file Chapter 11. And with respect to other debtor entities that did not file Chapter 11 or that filed Chapter 11 and were dismissed, again, we can't say whether the debtors, NRIA, had the exclusive right to file a Chapter 11 with respect to those entities. Is the restructuring plan available? Yes, it is available. It's available on Omni. Again, if you have not seen the plan yet, you can go onto the Omni website, and in the documents section, there is a subsection for plan and disclosure statement, which when you click on that, you'll be able to scroll down and see the plan and disclosure statement. I believe the solicitation motion as well. You can pull it there. Has NRIA obtained financing for ongoing operations? NRIA, because of its cash position, has been able to finance its operations without having to go to seek additional financing from a debtor in possession loan or other sources. There have been some discussions about potentially financing some of the development of the property if it makes business sense. But to date, they have been financing everything out of their own cash on their balance sheet. What is the anticipated date for reconciliation of all claims submitted to Omni? When is the voting for approval of restructuring? So we are hopeful that the contributing investor settlement will prove attractive to most investors and that most investors will accept the claim amount as listed on the schedule, which will make reconciling all the claims with respect to the contributing investors very straightforward and simple. As for how long it will take to reconcile all the other claims, that depends in part on how many people elect to opt out of the settlement, and also just how long it takes. It can take quite some time to reconcile claims generally, which is one of the reasons why we're hopeful that most investors will accept the contributing investor settlement. What is the status of review of proofs of claim? Same question. What is the process for sorting out all of this, given that many of us put in updated versions? One thing that will need to take place after the plan is confirmed, because multiple investors updated and amended their proofs of claim, is there will be what are called omnibus claim objections filed. These claim objections are done for multiple creditors at once, multiple claims at once. They do things essentially to clean up the claims register. So if somebody filed a proof of claim and they amended it three times, they will receive a claim objection to their first three proofs of claim out of their four, and they will be left with one resulting claim, which is their one claim, which is the last amended version typically. Claim objections will be filed. You'll have an opportunity to review, be in contact with the debtor as to whether or not they did it right, or the liquidation trust as to whether or not it was done right, and the claims register will be cleaned up appropriately. Those are the questions with respect to the plan disclosure statement and claims. We also had some questions about third-party lawsuits. Is Bill O'Reilly listed as a responsible party due to advertising and promoting NRIA? Well, we will be pursuing, or we expect at this point, that the liquidation trust will likely pursue claims against promoters and other people who marketed NRIA, depending on what the discovery and the documents show in terms of their culpability for the losses that were sustained. We are not naming anybody specifically right now in terms of who we believe the liquidation trust will pursue, but we are exploring all avenues and all parties who promoted NRIA as a potential source of recovery. Tell us more about going after Fox TV that was pumping this junk. It's the same answer to the same question, essentially. We are pursuing everybody who, we are analyzing claims against everybody who promoted NRIA to assess whether or not the claims are viable and worth pursuing. Is relief available against institutions that facilitated this fraud under know your client provisions? So I think saying know your client provisions typically relates more to banks and other financial institutions that are subject to federal know your customer regulations, KYC, and other anti-money laundering provisions. We are investigating claims against all financial institutions and everybody who facilitated the debtor's actions in this case. We are not sure which claims at this point the liquidation trust will pursue. We have not completed that analysis, but claims will be brought against anybody that the liquidation trust ultimately determines have valid claims against them. Have any funds been recovered from the main characters of the Ponzi scheme, Nick Salzano, Art Scutoro, Salzano's wife, for her no-show job? The debtors are continuing to pursue certain adversary proceedings that were filed early in the case against Salzano Grabato and Elena Beninsky, Salzano's wife, for her no-show job. Those cases are still ongoing. The debtors have obtained some default judgments against certain of them, which means that they have a judgment they can pursue to try and protect, try and obtain assets. To date, I do not believe any funds have been recovered, but that doesn't mean that anything won't be recovered, that they aren't pursuing avenues to recover amounts.
And yeah, let me add to that, obviously, the very big lawsuit that will be coming against these people has yet to be filed. And that's the one making them civilly liable for the entire fraud that has not been brought against them. It's plainly coming down the road against them for sure.
Those are all the questions we received in the registration. Lewis, shall we go through the Q&A now?
Sure.
I can't say that we'll get to every single question, but we'll just try and work through them until we run out of time effectively.
Well, Mike, the ones that are answered or have already been answered, let's just skip over.
Yeah. And I'm going to skip questions specific to specific parcels of real estate. Again, you can look at the disclosure statement for answers about that. So I'm not going to answer those. Will Mr. Casey be sued because he took money subsequent to his hiring, even though he knew the company would go into bankruptcy imminently?
I'll answer that, Mike. We're investigating everybody, anybody who is associated with the debtor pre-petition, period, end of story. We don't want to disclose or discuss further any elements of any ongoing investigation.
Right. Lewis mentioned classes of investors. How are these determined? How many classes are there, and what impact on distributions do those classes have? So under the plan, there is only one class of investors. There's a class of secured claims, a class of unsecured claims, which are basically vendors and other people who had a breach of contract, essentially, a normal vendor contract, essentially, with the debtors. And then there are the investors who made an investment in the legal entity and received an equity interest in the entities. So the secured claims are their own class. The unsecured claims are a separate class, and then the investors are a single class, class 5, under the plan. For purposes of the disclosure statement, are there any estimates for how much the litigation actions will cost to be brought and estimates of the potential recoveries? There are not currently any estimates for how much they cost, but it is always part and parcel of reviewing the claims that may be asserted to also analyze how much it would cost and what the most cost-effective way to pursue those claims is. And the liquidation trustee and for the liquidation trust will make determinations on how best and how much expense to put towards pursuing these claims in their business judgment, subject to the liquidation trust advisory board's advice. Twenty-5 to 30% much better than expected. Thank you. Could you re-explain the number 25 to 30%? Is that 25 to 30 of the net investor claim amount? So yes, that's 25 to 30% of the net investor claim amount. Additionally, and this can get a little bit technical, That is 25 to 30% on a net present value basis, meaning we are taking the amounts that we believe will be distributed in the future, and we are using a discounting factor based on interest rates in order to say how much will be distributed based on today's dollars. So currently with inflation at somewhere around 4%, 3 to 4%, and interest rates in the 4 to 5% range, money received today is worth more than money received 2 years in the future, 3 years in the future. So the 25 to 35% that we list in the plan is applying that sort of net present value function to arrive at an amount based on, you know, how long we think the distributions will go. If we only look at nominal claim amounts, it might be somewhere like 30 to 35, 30 to 40%, but we're trying to estimate how much in today's dollars people should receive on their claims.
Out of the real estate. And cash.
What amount roughly of the $550 million owed is joint venture money? The $550, and actually we currently believe that investor claims total about $518 million, $520 million. But none of that is joint venture money. That is all investments of actual cash in minus actual cash out. I'd like to hear more about recoveries against third parties. Again, we're not going to mention specific parties that we are pursuing today, but we are going and we are following every trail of breadcrumbs we can to the parties that we believe they're viable claims against.
I'll answer that real quickly a little bit more, which is that we've indicated this on prior discussions and prior town halls, but we have identified buckets of recoveries. The buckets of the recoveries do include banks. They do include other professionals involved pre-bankruptcy with the debtors. These are buckets where we're investigating. And there's, of course, the bad actors, people who promoted, people who were facilitators of the fraud, people who were referrals of investors, who were soliciting investors for this entity that pumped money into the investment scheme. These people will all are being explored, are being investigated, have received. We have over 90 to 100 subpoenas outstanding. We have discovery coming in the incredible amount of volume, and our professionals are going through it and exploring all the claims, and claims are being identified and they will be pursued against all these wrong actors, but it's likely going to be based on the timing through the trust. And you've asked about Ice Miller going through those. We will be pursuing those if retained by the trustee. So go ahead, Mike.
Next question is, real estate investment is supposed to fetch profits as time goes by. Why are creditors getting only 25% back? Where did all the money go? That is principally what we are investigating. Some of the money that was invested by later investors went to pay distributions to earlier investors. Some of it went to pay salaries. Some of it went to pay the debtors' marketing expenses. I believe the debtors were paying somewhat like something like 20% of their revenue, or 20% of their cash, effectively on marketing, for investors. Some of it went out improperly, potentially to vendors and to contractors. We are pursuing those avenues to figure out where the money went and to try and recover as much of it and to pursue claims against third parties that facilitated the debtors' Ponzi scheme as much as we can. But another part of it is that the real estate does fetch profits as time goes by, but real estate can only be sold at whatever its market value is. The real estate market 2 years ago, when interest rates were much, much lower, was better than the real estate market is today. And so there's been some movement in the expected price of some of these properties based on the fact that it is now much more expensive to get loans. Interest is much higher. The interest in these properties is lower because of the current real estate market. Is it possible to allocate some properties to a group of investors to develop on their own and maximize returns? That is not something I believe we are considering, or that the debtors are considering. I believe the debtors, there's just too much. There's too much ambiguity in that, too much potential for shenanigans, I think, to allocate some properties to a group of investors to develop on their own. So is the plan a liquidation? Is there any further development included to maximize returns? The plan is a plan to liquidate the debtor's current assets and not purchase any new assets, not purchase any new real estate parcels. But some of the debtors' parcels will continue to be developed and finished effectively over the next several years. So while it's a plan of liquidation, we're not just dropping everything and liquidating everything in a fire sale in order to just get as much cash as quickly as possible. We have been working with the debtors, and the debtors are working towards developing a plan that will pursue development of assets that make sense and sell assets that it doesn't make sense to develop.
Let me answer. There are two questions here that I've noticed have overlapping issues. One, if you do vote in favor of the plan and are a contributing investor, you will be automatically included as a party who will recover from the litigation commenced by the liquidation trustee against all the bad actors and all the recovery actions, because you will receive a distribution on the account of your claim from that trust. So the answer is yes, you'll be automatically included as a beneficiary of the trust in those recoveries. So the answer is yes, if you are a contributing investor. If you're not a contributing investor, the answer is until your claim is resolved, no. You have to have your claim allowed against the estate, and then you would be. In terms of the pursuit against on your own, I don't think we said that it is you may want to pursue actions separately on your own. I said you have the right to pursue actions on your own if you wanted to against third parties. The purpose of the settlement, the purpose of the contribution of the claim to the trust, is so that the trust can pursue them on behalf of the investors to maximize the recovery for all investors and creditors through the trust. It also avoids certain problems that the estate would have in terms of litigation against bad actors, and creates the ability to go after them on behalf of investors, which is usually more potent. So that's it. Mike, let's go ahead with the question.
Yeah, and just one more point about that. The estate can pursue claims both that the debtor has itself against these third parties for breach of contract and fraud and whatever, that the claims the debtor has, plus claims that investor has. And there's economies of scale effectively in allowing the debtor, the liquidation trust, to pursue all those claims together rather than having one claim on behalf of the debtors and one claim and a separate litigation on behalf of the investors. The next question, please explain again why you will not pursue clawbacks from earlier investors who received earnings above and beyond their 100% return of capital. This is my money that was used to pay them in a Ponzi scheme. As I mentioned before, part of the plan, and one of the things that will be filed in the next week or so, is an excluded party list. These are people that are not eligible for the contributing investor settlement, and it includes basically every investor that received 100% of their capital back or nearly 100% of their capital back. We did not include every investor who received most of their money back, but we looked at who received all of their money back in this, who got out without any losses. And those are the people that we put on that list. So those clawback actions against those people will be pursued. The vast majority of investors in this case received a small portion of their capital back in small amounts over time, directly in relation to the amount of time they invested. And it wasn't a huge amount, but we are reserving the right to pursue clawback actions against everybody who recovered all of their money back or most of their money back. What is the docket number to retrieve the plan? The docket number for the plan is docket 2228, and the docket number for the disclosure statement is 2229. So if you'd like to go on and download it, again, you can go to the Omni website under the Documents tab. There's a thing that says Plan and Disclosure Statement. You should be able to click there, and it should just pull it up. But if you're on the docket, again, the plan is docket number 2228, and the disclosure statement is 2229. If a creditor has multiple investments, will a ballot be provided for each of the investments? So, if a creditor has multiple investments, those investments will be aggregated for that investor, which leads to a question about whether or not the claims of investors who invested both on their own behalf and through an IRA will be aggregated. I will get back to you on that. I don't know the answer to that question, but I believe that one investor who has both an individual claim and an IRA claim will only be able to submit one ballot for both of those claims, but those claims should be treated separately given the separate tax treatment that those investments receive. Why are you mailing out USB sticks for ballots? Just do it all on the Omni site online, like the claims process. Save money. The bankruptcy code requires that we mail everything out. So it is not a choice that we have to not mail everything out. Under Rule 2002 of the bankruptcy rules, we have to mail the disclosure statements and plan out via the mail. And we're sending them through USB, so we don't have to print everything. But we don't have the option of just having everybody go online. When will these documents be distributed to investors? Hopefully the disclosure statement is approved on the date we mentioned previously. And then the disclosure, the solicitation package will hopefully go out shortly after May 16th. It needs to go out.
But everybody already has drafts. So everybody has it's on the system. The documents we're talking about are available on Omni right now and are available if you'd like to see them, as Michael said, on the docket on Omni. So you can see these documents now. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, so the docket, the disclosure package needs to go out 28 days before the objection deadline at the very least. I suspect it'll go out shortly after May 16th, but technically I think we have until, the second week of June or the first or second week of June to get them out. Again, we want to give people as much time as possible to review them and assess them with their attorneys and their accountants to see what makes the most sense for them. So hopefully we'll come out shortly after May 16th. In order to obviate the risk to pursue the litigation coming from investors voting no for the plan, why doesn't the UCC seek authority to file a class action on behalf of investors?
We're still looking at that. I think that it's an issue that we understand you've raised before. We know the question and we are looking at it.
The plan calls for some properties developed and then sold. Therefore, it is assumed there will be an initial distribution and additional distributions as assets are sold and or litigation settlements are received by the trust. Confirm and clarify. So, yes, in bankruptcy cases, typically there are interim distributions over time, and you don't have to wait for one lump sum at the end. The amounts and the timing of those interim distributions is left to the discretion of the liquidation trustee. So I can't say when those will start to come, but the ordinary practice is that you will receive payment over time until all the assets are resolved, and then you'll receive one final payment. As I'm scrolling through, my list keeps resetting. What if there is a mistake in calculating an investor's net claim amount? This is a very, very good question. The debtors are, as we speak, going through and basically, I don't want to say auditing is a little too strong, but they're checking and rechecking and testing the investor schedule, which will be filed next week or shortly thereafter, which should list the amount. We are hopeful that it will accurately convey the total amount of cash that the debtors received in from each investor, and then the amount that was paid out to investors. We are expecting to receive feedback from investors if that is not the case. And we will, if there are a lot of mistakes in calculating the investor net claim amount, we will discuss it. We'll discuss what the appropriate thing to do at that point is. But we're hopeful it'll be pretty accurate.
One of the questions is, how do I join the class action? This is not, this bankruptcy case relates to NRIA and all of its affiliates and all the bad actors. It is not the class action. The class action is a private group of lawyers or lawyers that want to pursue these claims on behalf of investors for their recovery. This is not a part of that class action. This is separate from the class action. This is a court-appointed procedure for the bankruptcy process to recover the maximum amount of the claim of recoveries for you out of the bankruptcy estate, as well as against third parties for claims for damage to you out of this investment. The class action is somebody else trying to create a class to go after these individuals, something separate and private. Mm-hmm. Right.
Are JVs being completely subordinated, essentially squashed? What about JVs that were given as loans without any linkage to a property or fund? I am not aware of any JV agreements that were given as loans without any linkage to a property or a fund. Based on the review of the JV agreements, I haven't reviewed all of them, but I've reviewed many of them. Even the JV agreements that were what we call secured loan JV agreements, still related to a specific property. The way those worked essentially was that the money that came up front was essentially repaid or converted to an interest in the fund upon the purchase of the property that those secured lending JV agreements were supposed to relate to. And so those interests, those JV interests with respect to that would be interests in the fund. So my understanding is that any cash that was paid in under a JV agreement and converted to an interest in the fund would be included in the net investor claim amount. But the JV interest that was supposedly given along with that, which relates to an ambiguous term of net profits on property, won't be there. Another thing to consider in connection with the JV agreements, and this is really the reality of this debtor generally, is that they purported to give investors a right to net profits on a property. The debtors did not run a profitable real estate business. They did not make money on essentially any of their individual properties. When you account for all the costs that went to developing these properties, they paid more than they got back in many instances, or they allocated more. So there were no net profits for people to receive. So that's another reason why the JV agreements, we believe, are appropriately subordinated and or simply objected to. I have a JV agreement for two projects. If they proceed with development and sale of both of these projects, will I receive additional money beyond the 25 to 35% when those properties are sold? No, you will not. The JV, essentially, because even if those properties ultimately sell, there will be no profits to distribute out, and any sort of recovery on the JVs is subordinate to claims, to the investor claims. All the money will be going to pay investor claims back. There will not be any payments under joint venture agreements in all likelihood. Who will be the trustee? No trustee has been selected yet. There haven't even been too many discussions of names, but it will be someone who has extensive experience with bankruptcy, extensive experience with real estate, and who has extensive experience being a trustee and who will know what to do and know how to, cost effectively pursue claims and, pursue and run a liquidation trust.
We have subpoenaed Madison Trust. That's one of your questions, and we've already answered. We are looking at all of the banks and all of the those who may have assisted and or facilitated or participated in the movement of money and the transactions in this case. So we have subpoenaed. We have just received, in fact, volumes of information and subpoenas from TD Bank just today. In fact, massive volumes. So we are investigating all issues, and have made substantial progress on those investigations. Mm-hmm. And we have the benefit, as Mike said, of the 2004 exams, which are, we've already gotten discovery where other lawsuits would have to start a lawsuit, then pursue investigating and pursue discovery. We have terabytes of information already.
Yeah. Does the 25 to 35% recovery estimate incorporate cash held by the estate today? The 25 to 35% range incorporates all of the debtor's assets other than litigation claims that may be pursued. So it includes all of their cash, all of their real estate. The only thing it does not include is recoveries on litigation, which are contingent and unliquidated and unclear as to how much will be recovered.
A plan is approved, by the way, when in this case, we have what's called a more than one impaired class. So if there's more than one impaired class of creditors, that's the creditors who aren't getting 100% of their legal rights and payment under the plan at day one of the confirmation, then you have to have at least one impaired class voting in favor. The investors will have voted in favor of the plan if 2/3 in amount and 51% in number of the investors vote in favor in that class in the plan. If they vote in favor, then they will have carried the class and the class will have voted in favor of the plan, and therefore one impaired class will have voted in favor. So to answer that question, that is correct. And I guess what else? We should probably end, I think, Mike, by around 4:30, 5:30, 4:30 Central, 5:30 Eastern.
Yeah.
So two more questions.
Yeah. Are these WebEx conferences being recorded? They are being recorded right now, and the audio for this will be posted to Omni in the next several days after we get it converted. So you can rewatch this. You could also watch all the previous town halls on the Omni website. To get there, if you go to the Omni website, in the right-hand side, there's a creditors committee box. And in that box, there's the town hall. You can go there. That's also where you would go to register for future town halls. We don't have any future town halls scheduled right now. We will schedule additional town halls once the disclosure statement has been approved and we know, you know, when we'll be able to talk about it. So be on the lookout for that.
And another question was, in terms of whether the funds recovered in litigation is on top of the real estate recovery, the answer is yes. We've discussed that. We're hoping that there will be substantial recoveries in the litigation against the wrong actors, as well as the facilitators of the fraud and or beneficiaries of the fraud. And so we anticipate that there will be substantial distribution out of those litigation recoveries. But again, that is to be commenced in the very near future, and also on top of the real estate and cash on hand.
Mm-hmm. There's one last question, I think. Maybe this would be the last question. Mm-hmm. If you opt out initially, can you later opt back into the contributing investor settlement? The plan currently doesn't include a mechanism for opting back in after you opt out. So everybody should try very hard to assess whether or not they want to opt out of the plan when they have the opportunity to do so. Because they in all likelihood, will not have an opportunity to opt back in later.
And last, I think we have to restate this as a final summary for everybody, and then we'll let everyone go. The plan and disclosure statement have not been approved. We are not asking you to vote at all on this plan or disclosure statement. We're explaining the documents that are currently, as we understand them, as drafted and filed on the docket that are available on Omni. You should vote on and consider when voting on the disclosure statement that's finally approved by the court, which has not happened yet. That's the document you vote on and the plan. You don't vote on what is currently here on the docket. This is the drafts we've asked the court to approve, subject to your review. You can all go out, look at it, retain counsel if you want, pro se if you want, file objections. But if you file something, it will be heard by the court on the hearing dates set by that court. So again, that's hopefully the summary of what we have to date. There will be, once that disclosure statement is approved mid-May, we hope to have thereafter a call that will discuss the actual court approved disclosure statement and the plan that is being proffered for approval. So again, thank you all for your patience. Hopefully this was informative. Mike, thanks again as always. And everybody, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, everyone.